AM Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Tom Rockman joins me again upon the publication of his third novel, The Italian Teacher. He has been described as among this generation's most exciting literary voices. The book begins in Rome, 1955, where Bear Bavinsky, a larger-than-life artist, has a family with Natalie, his wife and muse, and their five-year-old son, Pinch. Soon, the family comes apart, but not the worship that Pinch has for him. The shadow that the father has on a son's life is a theme explored in this book, and I'll get Mr. Rockman to tell us about Bear, Pinch, and their relationship that and the relationship that they contend with through the book. I'll ask him about artistry and fame, two other themes in the book. Tom Rockman was born in London, England, where he lives today. He was raised here in Vancouver, and he attended the University of Toronto and Columbia Journalism School before working as a journalist for the Associated Press in New York and Rome and the International Herald Tribune in Paris. He was last on this program when his first novel, The Imperfectionist, was published, and since he's written The Rise and Fall of Great Powers and the short story collection Basket of Deplorables. This new book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program, Tom Rockman. Mr. Rockman, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you're back in Vancouver for a spell, I guess, to talk about the book. You were, I guess, we're talking on a Tuesday, and I guess Monday night you were at an event for the Writers' Fest. Is that right?
That's right, yeah, the Vancouver Public Library.
Do you get out here often?
I get out here as often as I can. It's not always easy because it's a long trip from London and I have lots of duties there. But my parents still live out here, and so it's a pleasure to see them. And it's been great because the city just seems to grow and become more appealing and fascinating each time I come back. So it's always a pleasure.
Does London feel, well, I guess you were born there. Does it, and you've lived there for a while now. Does it feel like home for you? Because I've also read in interviews that you've done, either you described as or you yourself describe yourself as a Canadian author.
Yeah, I mean, I have Canadian citizenship and I have British citizenship, and I grew up here, and I certainly sound more Canadian, I think, although I do have all sorts of bits of English words coming out as well, but English accent. But so, you know, it's a complicated thing for me because I've lived in these two countries, but I've also lived in other places abroad, and figuring out precisely where I fit in has been something that I think I struggled with a lot when I was younger, and at a certain point gave up on the notion of having just one place that was fixedly mine, and instead felt like there were lots of different places that I was happy to absorb different features from. But Vancouver has a special place in my heart because it is where I spent all of my childhood, pretty much.
It sounds like I'm going through all the places you've lived, but you've also lived in Italy too, I understand. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I lived in New York and Toronto and Rome and Paris as well.
Yeah, and so the expat experience, I mean, that's something that you deal with in The Italian Teacher, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. It's something that seems to come up and has come up in all of my three novels. It's clearly something that I'm that I'm stuck in. I think that we're fascinated by, and I think it's funny because when I started writing, I was worried about not knowing if there was a particular small little neighborhood or city or country even that I would want to set my work, because so many of the writers that I liked had a clear setting. Mm-hmm. And for me, I because of what I was saying about feeling a bit rootless and confused about what my place was, I worried whether that would be a problem for my work. But in the end, the stories that I end up wanting to write were these tales of people who are a little bit confused about where they should fit and are floating around in limbo somewhat because they are expats, and so they're never going to be entirely from the place they're living in. And yet, on the other hand, they are, when they return home, they've changed enough that they're no longer obviously from there either. So that was something that has been the backdrop for all of my main characters so far. And it's I've come to realize from, you know, when I go around and tour with these books and talk to people that it's not such an unusual condition anymore, because so many people feel that they are a mix of things rather than just one thing. I mean, it's no longer the case as it was for how many countless generations. It's no longer true that you live where your great-grandparents would have lived. It does happen now and then, but you know, probably almost everybody I know is somewhere far flung compared to where they have been or where their families have been. And that's a new way of living for human beings, and one that has all sorts of challenges and richness to it as well. And so I think it's ended up being something I'm exploring in my books.
Yeah, and so who is it? Bear who contends with the expat experience in the book?
Well, it's all of them, really, in different ways. But the book begins in Rome in 1955, and at that stage, the main character of the book is Pinch Pavinsky, who's the son of this great artist, one of the great painters of his time. And Pinch is born in Italy, but he has no Italian on either side. His mother is Canadian and his father is American, and they both ended up there for reasons that appear in the book. And he grows up in this Italian environment, but his birthplace is not really, let's say, his obvious cultural home. And then he ends up moving on, and he spends time in Canada when he's going to university, and then he ends up in Britain later on. And that ends up becoming, you know, the fact that he doesn't have a really clear place of his own either ends up becoming a meaningful parallel to the fact that he's struggling to figure out quite where in the world he fits, what he should be doing, what fundamentally he is, and whom he should connect to. So it becomes it ends up being something that is representative of his larger story as well.
And throughout the book, the relationship that he has with Bear, his father, is something that he has to navigate. It's something that unfolds as well. To Bear, for just a sec, what does he look like?
Bear is a big, brawny, beardy guy who is not necessarily the biggest, toughest man around, but he's one of those people who after you've met him, you feel like he was a lot taller than he was, because he's a very powerful and potent character with a great deal of charm and charisma, and a great deal more charm and charisma than scruples, you could say. He's a guy whose main and maybe sole interest in life is to advance his artistic career, and everybody around gets sucked into that. But he's a man who lives his lusts and his passions and his appetites very publicly, and if you want to be around him, then you have to fit in with that.
Yeah, and what do his paintings look like?
Well, his paintings are abstract expressionistic works, but they're actually portraits, so they're strange sort of abstractions. That what he does is he will have a sitter before him, and he will do a detail portrait. So he will take a detail of the body of the subject and expand it, make it really huge on a gigantic canvas, so it ends up becoming abstracted on the image itself becomes abstracted. And in addition, these pictures are amazingly bright, wild colors. They're expressionistic articulations of the emotions of the painter, which was the style of that was very fashionable in the 50s. Particularly in New York and around there, and it's expressive of his personality too. That this kind of these bright, intense colors just splash wildly across the canvas. And although they are paintings of other people, it somehow feels like they're more paintings about him. Mm-hmm. And he never ever includes the subject's face in any one of his pictures, because really these are expressions of what he's seeing and not who they are.
And so he's married to Natalie, and they have the son, Pinch. What's the relationship between him and Natalie?
Well, it's a tortured one in many ways, because she is herself a very talented artist, but what she lacks is, among other things, she lacks the personality. And among the things that I'm discussing in this book are her raising. One of the questions I'm raising is what it takes to be a great artist, not just what it takes to do the art, although that's part of it, but also what it takes to be recognized as such, what it takes for the world to see or consider you to be a great artist. And the point that I want to make is that this is by no means a clear and straightforward judgment on the talent and quality of the work, but there's a great deal more that is at stake and that comes into play, and that it's actually a fairly corrupt system. And her character represents that, because she's a female artist at a time when the fashion was for these ribald, debauched, unscrupulous guys like Bear. Uh-huh. She's also working in a medium that is out of fashion, which is ceramics. Uh-huh. And while we accept that painting and sculpture are important artworks, there's this feeling that if it happens to be something like ceramics or let's say embroidery, or these are just considered lowly household crafts in many cases, although those distinctions are pretty arbitrary. So she's got a lot of things going against her, and she's a much younger woman than he is, a man, and they meet up and in Rome when she's just a student and he's there on a fellowship, and he is this dashing and very, very attractive and impressive guy who seems to be completely connected to the world of art that she has only known about in books, uh-huh. and magazine articles. He's a famous guy. He's been featured in Life magazine, and she meets him in an art supply shop and is bewitched by his charisma, and they end up having a relationship in which he ostensibly seems to be supporting her and encouraging her art, and yet ultimately it's his that is the ferocious force that is expected to move ahead, and that if she in any way requires anything of him, he's not so willing to give that. So it's one that let's say it's in a relationship that appears attractive to her from a distance, but ends up constricting and in some ways suffocating her and her work.
And so they eventually split up. Now to Pinch and their relationship, the relationship between Bear and Pinch. It's getting out of a father's shadow is hard enough, and I let alone someone who's larger than life, someone who's renowned as Bear is. And that's something that I guess Pinch has to contend throughout his life, right?
Yeah, definitely. And as Bear was with his wife, he's also in a way with his son, that his son is expected to mold himself to the great man and not expect anything, and not the great man is not going to bend his will or his expectations or wishes of what he's going to do with his ambitions and his art. And so the young man in growing up recognizes that if he wants to have a close relationship with this important artist, then he'd better adjust. He'd better accommodate and be the one who's fitting in, you know? And I think that's so often the case with difficult characters, that if difficult characters in our own lives, in our own families, that they may be charming and significant, and we want somehow to connect with them and stay in touch with them, but they offer a little back and, in fact, offer an opportunity to be there only if you fit in with them. And that's a situation that Pinch finds himself in. We follow it's really his life story, and so we watch him from childhood to late on in old age, and he is traveling through life trying to figure out quite what he is, given that he started out his path being something akin to an assistant or an aide to this important man, and he has to figure out later on quite what he's going to become. I think that sort of relationship where you're constantly folding yourself up to fit somebody else's needs is one in which often in adulthood there can be a reversal where somebody feels, you know, I've had enough of this, I'm going to be my own person, and it can lead to from utter devotion to deep hatred even. And without getting into the details of what happens, Pinch at a certain stage has a reversal of sorts, and in fact takes a secret step that will change everything forever.
Yeah, we don't really realize that when we admire people, or we go to their movies, or we buy their books, or you know, provide them with the adulation that you know artists deserve, or that we see, is just how that fame affects the lives of the people around them.
Absolutely. It's something that in the course of my research to write this book, I kept reading these tales and anecdotes about the great artists and what they got up to in private. And they're pretty appalling stories that you often come across. And what was striking is how accepting we have been of this for such a long time, that we have had this notion that the great and important artist is almost a different breed, somebody who is invested with this divine powers that from childhood they're miraculously gifted at this art, and they through their adulthood they live these wild unconventional lives, and they do so, we assume, in some way because it's necessary for them to be so creative and to produce the stuff that we admire and love, and they often take on board that kind of fantasy and end up wreaking havoc on everyone around them. And it's interesting because I was thinking for all the years of writing the book, last 3 or 4 years, about this, about whether the behavior of artists was merited, whether it was a bit of a put-on, and how much we are willing to accept in the name of what we love in culture. And then, over the past year, we've had so many cases in the arts that have come out of artists behaving in appalling ways. And I think that society is now beginning to ask some of these same questions and really doesn't yet have an answer about how much we're willing to accept and how much we need to condemn.
Yeah, fame has also changed, I think, in the last 25, 30 years. And, I mean, you look at who the president of the United States is and who the major celebrities are on television and on Instagram, say. You know, in Bear's time in the 1950s, you were famous because you were particularly talented in a field. Nowadays, you know, you can be president of the United States with just because you're famous or you once had a television show.
Yeah.
When we look at fame today, I mean, is that something in the course of writing this book that you found that fame has changed, and not just in the sort of the English-speaking world, but I mean in other countries. I think that the famous people of today are, I mean, you wouldn't believe that they'd be famous, say, 50, 100 years ago, right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's well put. I think that really there's been this strange uncoupling or decoupling of the talent or the accomplishment from the renown. And there was a point where, you know, we've always known that there are certain people who gain fame and you can sit around and argue whether they really deserved it or not, but never before the last little while of celebrity culture have we been in a situation where there are people who unambiguously have accomplished nothing. I mean, and are nonetheless some of the most influential people in the culture and even in the economy. I mean, there was that weird thing a few weeks ago where one of these reality star celebrities decided that she didn't like something on a Snapchat update.
Mm-hmm.
She made a public remark on this, and within a day, I think it lost, I don't know, hundreds of millions of dollars in value. That these people, when I read that story, I suddenly realized that it's not just the culture. These people actually really do have a lot of influence, even in the economy, and it's, and not to mention politics, as you were saying, with Trump and other clowns who have gained inordinate sway, and it's disturbing. It's very disturbing and a peculiar kind of society that we're building if those are the ones who we want to influence us or accept influence from.
Yeah. I hate to differentiate between legitimate famous people and not legitimate, but artists themselves, because we were talking a moment ago about just the you mentioned the volatility of some of these artists and the havoc that they've wreaked on others. Are creative people, talented people, say, are they different people altogether? I mean, one would think that the upheavalness and the volatility, I mean, that's necessary to be creative or talented. I mean, it's a sort of like a chicken and egg thing at this point.
Yeah, it's very hard to pick apart, you know, because it's so many of them have been that way. It's hard to know whether it could be several different explanations. It could be that it's necessary to behave in this chaotic way, to have the freedom of unrepressed creativity. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that this is a way of behaving that people would take up in any sphere if they were allowed to, and that we have granted special rules to those in in the arts, or it could be that there's something about that kind of unhinged behavior that doesn't necessarily help the art, but is a trait that is shared by artistic people. So there's all sorts of different ways of looking at it and understanding it, and when that's the case, it's usually true, I think, that there's a tiny bit of all of those answers in the truth. I don't really know what it is, but I have experienced myself in meeting artistic people in the literary world and in other forms of art as well. I have absolutely met many people who are playing the role of artist, you know, that in fact, it's part of what draws many people to enter the arts, is that this is a high-status position where you get to behave in pretty crazy ways and have people nonetheless treat you with a great deal of respect and admiration, provided that you succeed. You know, that there's, as much as there's, that it's a very high-status thing if you're considered a great artist, it's a very lowly thing if you fail at it. You know, if you're the guy who's always writing a screenplay that's never made into anything, then people start to think you're just a layabout after a while. So you have to pull it off. But if you pull it off, then you're granted all sorts of separate rules. And that's a corrupting factor. And there's no doubt in my mind that many people who are in that world are playing the character that they've seen in films and read in books and have imagined, because it's a pretty attractive and easy way to go about your life. And it's also one that can do terrible harm to those around you.
Now, so I mean, you're a creative person. You've had great success with your books. How do you explain someone like, you know, the terrible behavior of someone like a Faulkner or a Hemingway or a Norman Mailer? That larger than life personality that they cultivated for fame purposes. I mean, is that also a product, say, of their insecurity in terms of their own abilities to write?
Possibly. You know, I think that one of the things that the paradox about the arts is that in all cases, the artists that we respect are not the ones who are doing it for commercial ends, but ones who are doing it because they feel committed to the art, because they have some vision. At least that's the notion that we're led to believe. And that they're really pursuing this thing despite whatever the world thinks, that they've got a vision. They're going to take it they're going to enact this. And ultimately, the world and posterity will recognize that they were right, that the artist was right, and that the world was completely wrong in any time when they judge this to be substandard work. And so these sorts of characters, they are at the same time desperate for approval, usually, or else why would they be doing something that is founded on the notion of expressing something, whatever your art form, expressing something that will be viewed and experienced and hopefully move in some way other people, strangers, the public. They're all designed to do that as well. So they're not, if they were purely just private obsession of the artist, as the tale would have it, then why not just burn those bits of art or never publish the symphony if it's just for you? It's not just for the artist. It's actually because they dearly want other people to respond to them as well. And so this is it's a weird kind of contradiction locked into the notion that we have of the artist. And I think that one possible explanation besides this that could lead to some of the damaging and larger-than-life behavior of those characters you spoke of is also that, as in any very, very competitive line of work, as the arts are, then there are a few different ways that you can reach the top. One is by being a genius, and that's an extraordinarily rare thing, far rarer than the use of the word. It almost never exists that there really are geniuses, but there are a few who are talented in an extraordinary and almost inexplicable way, but almost none.
Yeah.
And another common route is by being ruthlessly dedicated to the work. And if you have both, then your chances are even better. And I think that that it could be that another reason why some of the behavior of these people can be so shocking when you hear the private details is because it's a personality type that ends up, or behavior type that ends up bringing people to renown. If when their children are crying, they ignore them and keep working, and in fact hear that crying and add it to their story and think, well, that's an interesting plot point, then those are precisely the sorts of behaviors that over time, whatever the field, can that kind of ruthlessness can help you succeed in a very, very competitive world. But it also strips you of your soul over time. And so there's a question of what sort of person you're going to become and whether that's worth it. But I think it's also important to note when I say all this that it is not obligatory that you be an appalling human being to be a good artist. There are good artists and great artists who have been very, very fine human beings. And I'm always encouraged to think of the latest Nobel Prize winner for literature, right, Katsuo Ishiguro, who is a superb, superb writer and also, by all accounts, a lovely human being. And I think that attests to the fact that it's not a necessary link. But it's just true of any vicious industry, whether it is, finance or the law or medicine or academia, that when you're talking about the top tier, the positions that people are desperately battling for, then there can be an advantage in being callous to everybody around in your own self-interest, sad as that is.
And so how have you managed to not fall in prey to that sort of, to that world of, because you have had success as a novelist, as a writer. Can you see how people get it? I mean, you obviously can see how people can get attracted to that and fall prey to that. I mean, how have you managed not to?
Well, it's something I've thought a lot about, and maybe that's my first step to trying not to get too deep into the horrendous behavior that is by realizing that this is a danger. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I'm now in my early 40s, but when I was in my 20s and 30s, my overwhelming drive was for the work, was to try to establish a career, I recently was listening to Knausgaard, the Norwegian Swedish writer, and he's made a remark that resonated with me, and he said that when he was younger, he would have cut off a limb to write a good novel. And I thought, yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, in the way that other people might feel they'd sacrifice their life when they join the military or something like that, and they almost they would feel that they would just willing to lose limbs for it. It was how it felt as well, that I felt that this mattered to me so much that I would do almost anything. The danger, of course, is that you'd be willing to cut off a limb, but you end up cutting off the limbs of all those around you, and which is something that could certainly be said of Knausgaard, given that a lot of his writing has ended up exposing and I believe hurting some of the people who are written about. So that's a major, major danger in this work, and maybe that drive is so intense that if you're willing to harm yourself, and you therefore be willing to others, and just because you want this thing so dearly and desperately. In my own case, I was really conflicted, particularly in regard to whether to start a family, and I felt that the sacrifice and devotion that I required for my work would perhaps make it impossible for me to have a family, and yet I did want one, and felt an increasing longing as I was getting closer to 40, and it was a struggle. But in fact, I tried to write out in a way through this novel, because this novel explores the idea of an artist who is so self-centered that he ends up harming those around him, and I wanted to test out the worst iteration of that experience of what I feared and dreaded becoming and see what that would look like. But I told the story not from the perspective of the artist, but from the perspective of his wounded child, so that I would be forced to see it up close. And I ended up, I think, somehow working through it all in the book. And what that'll mean for my future writing, I don't know. Maybe I'll be a lesser writer. And if that's the case, because I now have a child, and very happily so. And if it means that my work is diverted and less good in the future, then I'm ready to accept that. But that's just been my choice, and we'll have to see whether my work gets worse or richer, or who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, and you're working on another novel now, I understand. When you're in the midst of that, because these things take a while for writers,
mm-hmm.
Did you do other writing?
Oh, yeah, I always do. I always try to, particularly between fiction projects, I try to do nonfiction writing because I find it really enriches my fiction to continue to be engaged with the world and go out and report things and meet people and research different subject areas. So I'm constantly doing stories as much as I can fit in time-wise.
Yeah.
And I like to try to get travel in there as well. And, yeah, lately I've written things just off the top of my mind on virtual reality technology. I'm writing a piece on Rwanda, another piece I did recently on the art world as well, which relates somewhat to this book. And I've written some essays for the Globe and Mail as well recently, including one that touched on what we were talking about
yeah.
in terms of the artist's behavior and what is necessary and dangerous in that. I always try to keep a hand try to keep circulating in the world beyond my study.
Yeah, that piece in the Globe and Mail that you referred to just a moment ago. I mean, that's the one, the wonderful story you told. Well, I don't know how wonderful it is of Faulkner and what he told his daughter, who was telling him not to drink anymore.
Yeah. He said nobody remembers Shakespeare's children, and that chilling answer. And in a way, you know, that directly or indirectly, that's a thought that a lot of artistic people have, that they are working for posterity and they are working, they think, on a higher plane than the rest of those around them. And that ends up being endorsed by their enablers and supporters in the culture who come around and say, you're so great, you're so wonderful, to the ones who were successes like Faulkner and end up corrupting them and making them feel, well, perhaps, you know, my time is more valuable than my child. Perhaps my ideas and attention is more worthy than theirs.
Yeah.
And that's obviously whether one decides there's truth in that or not, it is unquestionably a corrupting and dangerous sort of thought to have on a human level.
Well, one of the more beautiful pieces that I've read of yours in recent years, and I reread it a couple of weeks ago, was the one, I think it was the Washington Post, where you talked about having to your sister was sick and subsequently died, and you had to deal with her library.
Yes.
What's your library like? And in terms of how much reading, because this is what interests me, is how much reading you do while you're writing. I mean, if as a writer, I mean, reading is inevitable. It's necessary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is necessary, and I always try to start my day with some reading. In fact, I always do that just to kind of get the cogs turning. And it's vital. But funnily enough, you know, when I'm writing fiction, I find it hard to read other fiction. I think this is quite a common experience for writers that you can. There's a danger of being infected by that style because you're reading a polished piece of published work, whereas what you're doing is going to be presumably in a more preliminary stage. And you can start to kind of ventriloquize that style in a way that you don't want to do if you're not careful. So I tend to read more nonfiction when I'm writing fiction and more fiction when I'm writing nonfiction.
And it's a beautiful piece, and I suggest people pick it up. You can get that online. A lot of the books you had to give away, some you kept. What's the size of your library there in London?
Gosh, I don't even know. I've never counted, but I like to be surrounded by them. You know, they're sort of old friends, and they feel like my intellectual history written across the wall. So, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, and hopefully hundreds more ahead.
Yeah. And so in the age of reading off of phones, off of devices, have you avoided that?
Oh, yeah, I don't. I mean, I read news on my phone when I'm traveling and things like that, but I don't read books on phones ever. I've never done that. I've tried on a Kindle once, and I just didn't really feel right. I didn't like the fact that you can't tell where you are in the book, that you're not moving along in terms of pages. And I like the technology of ink and paper. It's
yeah.
a pretty good one. You can even drop it in a puddle, and your battery never dies.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too, is that I find that because I've had to read stuff on a screen. You don't remember things as you do. You know, I mean, like, something in your book, well, I remember that. That was on the left side on the bottom of the page. And so you're looking for that, but you can't do that when you're on a device. It's been such a pleasure talking to you again, and I'd wish you good luck with this book, but, I mean, the reviews have been quite good, and the sales have been good as well.
Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure talking again.
The book is called The Italian Teacher. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Tom Rockman, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.